702.
Call us on 011-883-0702.
Good evening to you, Simeon, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show, Kushwal.
Only a pleasure. Only a pleasure, mate. Look, for the longest possible time in South Africa, I guess we've had an issue with with the liquor industry. It's always been sort of a naughty stepchild when it comes to the world of business. There's always been a concern around what happens in the liquor industry, whether it be people trading without licenses or, selling stuff from under the mattress, et cetera, et cetera. There's been a long, long history with it. Why is this a concern? 27 vendors, liquor vendors, I see in the Western Cape having been issued this particular fine.
Yeah, I think it's important to note, that alcohol generally is a controlled, is a regulated substance, and according when licenses are issued, we expect those licensees to operate within the conditions of their license, and of course, not to be an undue burden on us on society generally. So accordingly, when the license is issued, they are required to comply, and if they do not, then the Western Cape Liquor Authority is entitled to act against those licensed operators to ensure that they mind that the conditions are imposed to ensure that community interests are also protected in a way. So the hours of trading, for instance, the extent to which the premises constitutes a nuisance or a threat to communities, drunk and disorderly behavior on those premises at those liquor outlets. And of course, when we receive complaints, or at least when the liquor authority receives complaints, they are expected to act. They then convene the tribunal. Those errant operators are then brought before the tribunal, and the matter is then heard, and the tribunal determines an appropriate sanction in those instances that are proven.
I mean, that's a very important point that you're raising there, and we'll get to sort of what the sanctions would be against these particular traders. But let's look at it. I know it's 27. I don't know if it's 27 different offences. I don't know if it's 27 different incidents that led to the situation. But what are some of these regulations that they've breached, some of these offences that they've committed?
Yeah, very often, by and large, the complaint that we receive is when the premises is operated in a way that it becomes a threat to patrons generally. If you have an establishment, it's about controlling that establishment, taking into account that there may be persons that become rowdy because of the abuse of alcohol. They are served way too much alcohol under the circumstances. Mm. And then the premises generally becomes problematic. You'll find that violence will break out. There'll be assaults to and fro. And invariably, especially when it comes to within communities where these they operate, you'll invariably find often serious assault happening, and basically a lot of criminal activity as well. So it's incumbent upon the license holder to operate the business in a way that it doesn't constitute an undue threat to the communities and also to patrons that visit their premises. So those 27 that you referred to, it would have been over the last, especially a number of them within the lockdown period. Bear in mind there were times that all of them could not operate. So for those periods that they were operating, it became very critical for the Western Cape Liquor Authority to act against that, especially since it has a direct link with the capacity of our health facilities and services within the Western Cape, as was apparent from the statistics. Availability of beds, for instance, is a serious challenge if trauma is not reduced or kept low. Within the lockdown, it was possible to manage that down to the extent that there were sufficient beds to accommodate COVID-related patients.
I mean, that's an important point that you're raising there, because I guess the rationale behind national government initiating the shutdown that then led to a ban on the sale of alcohol, during the lockdown and, you know, other substances, especially around alcohol. I think there was a general consensus and understanding that as much as it seemed to be harsh, seemed to be inconvenient, the fact of the matter is the reason why the booze was taken off of the shelves in the first place was to prevent those casualties that you are talking about. And we saw it unfortunately come to life once the alcohol was back on the shelves, that we went back to square one, where a lot of people found themselves in car crashes, in assaults, and you know, it increased domestic violence and abuse, etc., etc. So all of those ills that are generally associated with alcohol consumption then suddenly picked up. So are you then saying that as during that particular period where there was supposed to be an understanding that we should not be selling and trading in alcohol, that some people who are in the business were then in fact trading alcohol during that period?
I think it would be more those periods when there was a slight relaxation. I think it was easier to produce when there was an absolute ban on the sale of alcohol. Mm. But in those instances where you had like limited periods, like let's say, for instance, you had to operate until 10 o'clock in the evening, and some of the vendors could not resist operating beyond those hours. Also bear in mind that invariably, the ratio as far as trauma is concerned, the later or deeper into the evening, midnight hours you go, the more pronounced trauma is associated with alcohol. That is our experience generally as well. So it made sense then to reduce hours, trading hours. So we would then vigorously, monitor those instances. We respond to complaints, I should say. The liquor authority responds to complaints that they receive from members of the public, that then would indicate where this is happening. They visit these premises, are the inspectors of the Western Cape Liquor Authority, and then they are served with notices. They appear before the Liquor Licensing Tribunal, and which then hears the evidence and then decides what would constitute an appropriate sanction. In many of these instances, of course, you find that some of them would be suspended, as you indicated in the press release. I think so 1.3 of that 2.5 the amounts of the fines were suspended, and in other instances you'll find a variation of the conditions as well. That could happen. Mm. What is important to note, while we speak about trauma and the impact of that, it's also understanding that when you socially gather and alcohol is involved, you find that people are inclined to not be as vigilant as far as the protocols for COVID-19 is concerned. So they'll speak to each other, they'll be in close proximity of each other, and invariably, you know, it just leads to the virus spreading. And so people are just inclined to become less vigilant as far as that is concerned. So the social gathering aspect is also then a critical aspect. Alcohol plays an important role in terms of that as well.
And I guess that the biggest problem then in that instance, as you had pointed out, is that especially in the Western Cape, and it's not just the Western Cape, but I mean, there are some examples that come up immediately. As you would recall, the tin roof incident, the infamous tin roof incident, where you had the situation where a bunch of school kids got together, had a big fat party, 47 of them ended up being infected with COVID. 35 of them were in matric, and just yesterday, by way of a conversation, I found out that some of those kids had to miss out on their matric exams because of that, that situation that they found themselves in. Unfortunately, what then happens with the sale of alcohol, then, as you pointed out, the later people frolic and drink, the more irresponsible they become and the more likelihood you would have an incident. Unfortunately, what that then in turn leads to is a greater problem. You have these super spreader events.
Yes, Bushwell, you articulated it very well there. I think that, you know, you just lose all your inhibitions. You become, you just basically subject yourself. You're not attentive to what it is to protect yourself against the virus. And everybody is just happy-go-lucky, you know. And those gatherings then become the super spreader events.
So, I mean, is this, I mean, with those situations, taking those situations into account, taking many of the other events into account surrounding this, is this the Western Cape government's, you know, opportunity to not crack the whip per se, but you get what my drift is, to take this seriously and to say that, guys, listen, we're sitting with a problem. We, right now, as it stands, the garden route is basically off limits to people. It is, you know, under, you know, more stringent regulations than the rest of the country. Cape Town is approaching a peak as well. So we need to take this stuff a little seriously and a little more seriously. And on that basis, we need to protect ourselves and you know, do the right thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important also then for all the alcohol vendors to understand that. The sooner we you know, the more we limit the spread at this point in time, the sooner we can get back to normal, so to speak. Mm. And unless we get this under control right now, we won't be able to just open up as soon as we possibly can. This is just going to go along the situation as far as COVID-19 is concerned. It's a tough time right now to take the festive season, what you associate the festive season to be with, family and the like. But we all, even as families now, have to think whether we can justify, you know, having big get-togethers. To what extent do we want to risk exposing an entire family to that, meeting another family as an example? You know, and if we interlink all those engagements, let's say you're going to one tonight, you're the next tomorrow, you go to another, when you interlink with another group of people, we are just simply required to be much more responsible and much more vigilant as far as this is concerned. Unfortunately, as we say, once alcohol is also at play, that's
mm-hmm.
so much more difficult to do.
Yeah, no, for sure. It does become a serious concern. I mean, but simultaneously, with these measures that you are taking at the stage, with this crackdown, for example, in the liquor industry, issuing these 27 non-compliant liquor vendors with with this particular fine, making sure that we don't end up with a crisis, as we we're already sitting with somewhat of a crisis, but not worsening the crisis as it stands. The one thing that stands out for me immediately is, isn't there an opportunity or a risk or a possibility of then driving these types of activities underground? So instead of, and then I guess you've spoken to that already, whereby we already had a curfew in place, but if you look at the Western Cape, Cape Town in particular, not only Cape Town, but I mean the whole of the Western Cape is a popular tourist destination at this time of the year. Whether you're going down to Langebaan, whether you're going to Cape Town, whether you're going to Saldanha Bay, you know, people like taking the opportunity for a nice holiday in that region. And for example, beaches are closed on certain days, especially along the garden route. So Christmas Day, you can't go to the beach, I think, nationally now. People can't go out and frolic and drink till 4 or 5 in the morning and do their thing and have a lekker time. So ultimately, isn't there then a possibility that you'll have a couple of business owners that decide we'll have a pub lock-in? We'll close the doors, we'll shut the doors, keep the music low and hope that there's no police that drive by nearby and hear what we're doing. Isn't that a possibility that people are going to drive the stuff underground and as a result you sit with a bigger crisis?
Of course, I mean, there will be those that would be opportunistic in terms of, you know, wanting, of course, to continue doing business. We can understand the urge or the need for them to do exactly that. However, where we become aware of that, it's unfortunately so that if we have rules that we introduce, then the rule basically, the sole purpose of that is almost to say the bigger good, the larger good, if I can term it that way. And if we do not buckle down right now, we're not going to get to the end of this, to a situation where we can revert back to where we were previously. I think that's the important comment to make. The other thing is, even if it does have that effect, meaning people become much more cautious of that, it is still having the desired effect, which means there will only be so many people being able to go into a particular space. I think that's an important thing to note as well. It would clamp down on the kind of engagement, the social gatherings nonetheless. If you have to go underground to do it, there's only so much space you can do that within. Mm. So it will still have that desired impact, I think. Of course, if you caught doing it, then of course you'll be one of those statistics as far as the fines are concerned. And I think we just simply need to stick by enforcing those that we are capable of doing and trying to get most of the citizens of the Western Cape to comply and all the vendors for that matter especially, to get them to understand that besides the fact that we'd like to see COVID ultimately be completely eliminated by way of the vaccine in the long term, but also by just stopping the spread, we also want to see a reduction in harms caused by alcohol over the long term, because that challenge still continues. That challenge will continue beyond COVID as an example. So whether it be crashes or whether it be violence associated around areas where excessive drinking or alcohol use takes place, bear in mind that within our context, social context, there's a lot of binge drinking still happening. And we need to, to make some kind of dent as far as that is concerned. We, in the Western Cape, we have developed a white paper on alcohol's harm reduction, which clearly indicates the policy position of the Western Cape government towards alcohol and its impact on the impact of its harm on society. We realize that, and everything we do as far as when we consider alcohol-related matters is to understand to what extent we regulate the industry so as to reduce the harms and the impact of harms on our society.
I mean, one of the things that we also need to talk about, Simeon, is then the societal attitude or the community's attitude towards what we are having this conversation around. Because the one thing that stands out for me immediately is that this type of stuff would not be a concern or a problem, or we wouldn't necessarily be talking about this in the first place, if we as society or as community members behaved ourselves quite generally. And what I'm just talking about there in this instance is that as a business owner, let's say, for example, I'm running a restaurant. Alternatively, I'm running a little pub or bar, whatever the case may be. I'm not going to break the rules and stay open beyond 10 p.m. if I had compliant customers who actually 5 minutes before 10 or whatever other time you can think of, before 10 o'clock at a reasonable time, get up and leave, and make sure that they make their way home. That's the first problem. The second problem is the smuggling of booze and cigarettes, as an example, during level 5 was as a result of non-compliance. So how do we then get into a space whereby people actually behave themselves and that we make sure that people are actually compliant and that they behave themselves? How do we change the mindset and the attitudes of ordinary folk?
Yeah, I think that's a million-dollar question. In relation to human behavior, to what extent does the systems and processes and how our society functions condone such behavior? So if there's a critical mass developing that would indicate that kind of behavior is socially unacceptable, then certainly we'll start making a difference. However, and especially if you look at the youth and young drinkers, for instance, there is too much being associated with prestige and I don't know what, in terms of being in or whatever the case may be, around alcohol, and it's glorified in a way that it's okay. And if you can drink certain labels, for instance, you fit into a certain mold. All of these things need to change, and I think, and over time, it will change. But it also takes on another level the need for us to regulate it in such a way that, for instance, you do not sell to minors, as an example. So you're making sure that you hold people accountable for that. So if I give you a license to operate and sell liquor, then certainly you must understand that you sell to somebody who one is not already in a position that he can't hold his liquor for that matter. So that is the requirement for the person. That person must understand that if you do that, you're threatening your own business. Because if I catch you doing that, the regulator will hold you accountable and possibly rescind your license. And if you sell to a minor for that matter, you must then be reminded that if you do that, you're threatening your livelihood and your license. So the more we do that, the license operators would then become, would then understanding that protecting their asset or protecting their business and the goodwill of their business, it is better to operate within the ambit of the law. And I think this is where we want to go, and this is ultimately, if we have that kind of responsible behavior, the compliant nature of our operators, the liquor operators, the retailers, whether they be restaurants in terms of having wine with your meal, or whether they be off sales in terms of the volume of liquor that they sell. I mean, I can't sell you a truckload of alcohol, and I'm not satisfied that you are a trader yourself. I mean, where are you going with a truckload of beer as an individual just coming into an outlet? So those questions must be asked. And that is the kind of, shall I say, the checks and balances in the system. And the liquor outlets, if they knew that, know there are severe consequences, if they do not stick to the prescripts and the law as far as this is concerned, they must then be threatened as far as their business is concerned. Of course, with that, there's a lot of other things, such as parents being responsible in terms of their kids.
That's such an important point that you're raising, especially around the responsible parenting. I mean, how many minors in some communities would you'd go to, you know, especially over this holiday season, and you'll see children walking around with fruity bits of alcohol drinks, you know? What we typically refer to as cider is the sweet stuff, the stuff that men get made fun of if they drink it, you know. And this time of the year is where you see young lighties, quite frankly, 13, 14 years old, if not even younger, running around with the stuff. And you think to yourself, whose parents, what are these people thinking? You know, why on earth, how would a mum or dad or an uncle or an aunt or granny or whoever hand over the stuff and think that it's okay for this child to be consuming the stuff? I mean, it's just, it boggles the mind.
No, absolutely. I think that is why and the more socially acceptable that is in the home environment, the more problematic it becomes. Bear in mind that if you're a youth, that is particularly, because, I mean, as a youth, we didn't stay at home. You want to be out. So wherever you're going, you're going to be drinking these ciders and you know, fancy sugary drinks. Because unlike when, I think, many, many years ago, when alcohol just tasted either like, you wouldn't drink it.
Either beer or spirits.
You wouldn't drink it because it tastes horrible. It's only afterwards when it becomes an acquired taste, and then after that, generally it's social pressure that pushes you in that direction. Now it's sugar, and basically it just tastes as good as a Coke, for that matter. And that is a serious challenge. So the question that then must come in is, how do we make it difficult as far as those products are concerned? Are they taxed much more in terms of their sugar content and the appeal they would have? Do we start looking at ensuring that they're not advertised in a way that they attract the youth to? You know, there's such a lot of things that must be taken into account to try and make it less accessible. Now, the regulator and those of us in that space must ensure that we start developing mechanisms to hold people accountable for that behavior.
The final point that I wanted to raise, and you alluded to it and you pointed to it quite a bit, and I think it's an important issue, you know, to talk about, this issue, and you made mention of people's livelihoods. Because ultimately, yeah, I'm, for example, the liquor trader. I have a liquor license that allows me to do ABCD. I contravene it completely. So I'm running a restaurant, but I'm allowing people to buy bottles of beer and walk out with it, you know, or to, you know, because guess what? I have to close at 10 anyway, so they might as well take it with them. Or alternatively, I'm letting people sit in my establishment till 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and then I want to act like a, you know, like a victim when I get shut down by the police and people like yourselves. I mean, the question is, what are some of the sanctions that I could possibly face if I conduct myself or behave in that particular manner?
Yeah, if you're a licensed operator, meaning that you have a license to trade, and that license could be on or off consumption. If it's on consumption and you allow, in the instance that you now related, you allow somebody, a patron, after their meal to take a further bottle home with them, then of course, if that becomes known, and in one way or other it comes to the notice of the regulator, in our instance of the Western Cape Liquor Authority, then you could be hauled in front of the liquor licensing tribunal. The tribunal has a range of things that it can take into account in coming to and determining what is an appropriate sanction. I think the worst sanction possibly is losing your license, your trading license. And let me tell you how considerable that is. If you think of any business and trading in any business, having a license to sell liquor with that business increases the asset value of that business considerably. Now, if the liquor authority then can withdraw that license, that is basically it can damage your business severely. So it is a severe sanction in that way. We find, for instance, that people, some of these outlets, easily pay up to $300,000 in fines because the value of that liquor license still gives them that money. So there are considerable fines that can be imposed.
I mean, that's a serious one. And if I'm not mistaken, if you've lost your liquor license, that's tickets for you. You can't get it back.
No, you have to reapply ab initio. It's like for the first time. And it's going to be much harder, of course, because your behavior will be on record.
And apart from that, I mean, you could be turned down on the basis that, listen, previously you lost your license because you were doing things that led you to lose your license in the first instance. Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, no matter what province you're in, no matter what region of this country it is, there's plenty of people that see the financial value of selling booze in one or the other shape or form. And so the waiting lists tend to be long.
Yeah, I mean, considerably. If they will protect the license, that is our experience in our engagement with the Western Cape Liquor Authority, is that vendors would protect their license as far as they possibly can. And accordingly, if we are able to inspect them much more regularly, then we'll also find a greater compliance from their side. I think that is the important thing to us. And if you'll just allow me to say the following, Bushwa. You know, very often you'll find communities objecting to the granting of a license.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a process that, though, you consult the communities, the applicant would put out a case or warrant the approval of a liquor license, while the community and representatives of the community would object to such a license. At the end of the day, let's assume the license is granted. Then a lot of the concerns of the community would be addressed in terms of conditions imposed. Now, I think very often communities would walk away and think they lost, but that is not the way to approach it. After having considered all the aspects of the application and having considered the merits of the application, a license is granted, and the community's attempts are made to accommodate concerns by introducing or granting the license subject to certain conditions. Now, if communities are aware of that, they can actually then monitor the behavior of that outlet based on the license conditions.
Hmm.
And they, each time that they object or indicate that that operator is not functioning within the conditions of the license granted, they can go to the liquor tribunal and report the outlet. If you do that repeatedly, I can assure you, after three strikes, that outlet will probably lose its license in any event. So I think, and I mentioned this because I think it's almost like many people think that the winner takes all situation when a license is granted. It is not. Communities are actually empowered if they succeed to introduce conditions that will suit them and then monitor those outlets and those license holders against those conditions.
I mean, it's extremely important that you highlight that. I think for, especially as you said, for communities, unfortunately, we do live in the myth, as you said, that the winner takes it all, and now you've been granted your liquor license and people think that you... the person who's making a noise next door to you, et cetera, keeping you up at night, can get away with murder, basically, and do whatever the heck they want to. But you are actually empowered. You can take action, and people should then take action. That's the only way that we'll be able to solve these problems. Just in conclusion, there very quickly, Simeon, let's just take people through the costs and the process for obtaining a liquor license, because it's not an easy process. It's also not cheap. Either. Just very briefly, what does it take on average for a person to obtain a liquor license?
Well, as far as the cost is concerned, I think if you do it yourself, strangely enough, there's only cost related to, you know, submission of certain let's say, documents, and then whatever it costs to produce information as far as those documents are concerned. However, we are aware that there's a considerable industry of processing these applications. And in some instances, of course, these can become very technical in nature, especially when you need to apply for, let's say, a rezoning of the area where the outlet is supposed to be. So let's assume you're in, for instance, in an area where the zoning is residential, you're going to have a considerable process that you have to embark upon in order to get zoning for business purposes that would allow you then to have a license within that area. That again then makes it very complicated, and in all probability will require assistance in terms of how to motivate the rezoning. But as far as the application and submission of the documents are concerned, the Western Cape Liquor Authority just will hand you the documents and you complete the documents, and then you provide all documents they request of you and that may be required in addition to what you provide. So that is there. I am aware, however, that some, shall I say, consultants will charge anything between 30 to 60,000 to process the entire application. But I mean, that's a cost if you do not want to go that route. So you'll find that most of the big retailers would have somebody on retainer to do that for them. But we find that it is possible to do it on your own. It's just that you're going to know a little bit more and have to read up a little bit more on it, and then also to obtain all those documents that will be required of you. But I think you can actually do it on your own.
And on average, how long does it take you to obtain it?
Well, it is processed, there's a time frame to get it. I can't confirm the exact period, but depending on all the information that is required and whether the zoning and those things are correct, it could take up to, that can be in about 6 months, and in some instances longer than that. But I think there would be time frames, but I know, sorry, that there are time frames once it kicks into a certain, so by a certain date, certain things must be processed. So if you respond to the request, then you're probably looking at like 6 months, 6 to 9 months for that.
So, and the point that I'm making is that it's obviously pointless then for you to go and stuff it up through illegal activities after having gone through that lengthy process and a difficult process ultimately to be able to obtain your liquor license. I'm seeing that there's one or two calls coming through, Simeon. I don't know how similar or how dissimilar the processes are ultimately between applying for a liquor license, say, in Gauteng in the Western Cape. But I have someone here from Gauteng that has a question around the process. Obviously, based here in Gauteng and Gauteng related, I don't know, are there similarities? Would you be able to provide some form of assistance or guidance in this instance, or should we skip it?
For Gauteng, I wouldn't know, but I mean, unless it's a very generalized question, but each province has their own legislation as far as that is concerned.
Okay, should we take a shot in the dark and see what Thabo is to say?
Let's see.
Thabo out of Soweto. Thabo, you heard what, I don't know if you heard, but Simeon said he is based in the Western Cape, so he might not be able to help you with specific regulations in Gauteng, but let's hear what your question is.
My question is, I wanted to find out, like, how long do you renew your license? Because we're having a problem with the current Chawela, where we don't sign as a resident for the renewal of this liquor license. And this guy is playing music very loud.
Oh.
They don't study and all those things. And he's giving us hard times. And they urinate everywhere. And they park the cars in the gates and everything. You know, it's hectic.
I hear you. Okay, thanks for that one, Thabo. Number one, I think maybe the important point of departure is there a renewal period? So in other words, do I have to renew my liquor license? And second to that, is there any form of community consultation? But then I guess it does go back to the overall point that Thabo is making there, is that this person should probably be reported to the liquor board in the first instance as opposed to having to wait for a renewal process, isn't it?
Yeah. Now you're very right as far as that is concerned. It's an interesting concept because I think in a number of circles there's talk now of making licenses almost like a concession instead of a permanent license. It's a discussion in a very infant stage at this point. But I mean, it's nowhere near being considered for legislation. For that matter. But coming to Thabo's specific challenge, here is now such a scenario that you have an outlet that is creating other difficulties within the environment. Mm. There are clearly not enough ablution facilities. There's clearly not enough parking for all the cars coming to this outlet where he is based. So the license conditions, he has to get a copy of the license conditions if he possibly can. And that is actually quite easy if he goes to the liquor authority applicable in Gauteng, ask for that license to see the conditions, and then report them if against those license conditions they are not doing that. So if there are people urinating, patrons urinating in the street and like, we have a provision in our act in the Western Cape that would then get our inspectors out, and the inspectors would go and investigate, and then almost like issue an interdict against the operator. So they would have to come to the liquor tribunal and explain why they should not be suspended from operating until they show that they have systems to control the situation where they are.
But during that particular period, they're not allowed to trade?
Yeah, well, it depends how serious it is. You can then ask as soon as possible if you can get them before the liquor tribunal in 48 hours. And during that time, then the tribunal will consider it, and then a provisional order could be made. And then you can have a return date to see whether to make that final. Normally what happens, the operator would then go and give some kind of assurance of what they would be doing, and then our inspectors would monitor them for after that and to see whether it is necessary to make the order permanent or not. But as I've indicated to you, it's a serious sanction to threaten to withdraw their license.
I mean, I'm going to ask a very blunt and blatant question, and if you're talking just from the Western Cape's perspective, or from the Western Cape's point of view, I'd fully understand that. But part of my concern, and based on what Thabo had to say, is compliance with liquor license with liquor license conditions seems to be a serious concern, especially in a lot of our previously disadvantaged, for lack of a better term, black communities. And when I say black, I'm talking about, I'm being all inclusive, colored in black communities in particular. You know, what is the issue there? Is it just not being enforced properly? Because I'm thinking that there's many, you know, formerly white suburbs where that type of thing just wouldn't happen. You know, if I guess if you drive to Melville in the evening after on a normal night of revelry and fun, you would maybe see one or two people having a pee on the pavement. But it's a rarity, whereas unfortunately, in a lot of other, you know, our previously disadvantaged communities, it's almost become stock standard behavior. And that's really, really not on.
Yeah. First of all, can I put it this way? I think that I think generally, and I think we can talk about this because I think we experience this based on the communities where we come from. We do not squeal. We're not inclined to squeal upon, let's say, those within our communities that are trying to run businesses, whatever those businesses may be. So we tolerate and we also accept a lot of things, I think. I think we must now start entering or develop a culture whereby we hold people accountable. We hold our fellow citizens accountable for their behavior and the impact of their behavior on our communities. And I think that is something that will, I suppose, only change over time. But can I also a clear distinction between those that operate with licenses and those who do not? If you operate with a license, then the authority, I'm talking about the regulating authority, can do something about it, which means your license is ultimately the bargaining tool that you have to operate. If you are an unlicensed, which means you would just be a should be in that doesn't have a license to operate in that particular area or at all, then by and large, the authorities would have been a normal policing authority because the Western Cape Liquor Authority, in our instance, only have jurisdiction over licenses that they have granted. And that is an important distinction to make. So you would rely heavily on your normal law enforcement of the Metro Police or the municipal police, for that matter, or the South African Police Service to come out. Now, they would normally come out then based on the kind of threat and the kind of, shall I say, the kind of nuisance that outlet may be in that specific community. So I think that is an important distinction to make. But increasingly, I think we're going to have to develop almost like a rights-based culture for citizens and mobilization of citizens to insist to have a community space that they own. And I think that in the broader and increasingly we are finding that we must develop those partnerships with activists within communities that want to own their community spaces. It's not only a one-dimensional thing from a law enforcement point of view, but increasingly we're going to have to approach this from communities starting to understand that people that operate in their space must subscribe to a basic standard of existence that doesn't threaten the rest of the community. And I think we are a long way off as far as that is concerned. Yeah. And I think that fundamentally is the difference between the two areas that you earlier referred to. Why is it in Melville you won't have that kind of situation?
Well, but I think I think then, you know, that just turns me on to the fact that, I mean, you and I need to have another conversation at, maybe not now, or not maybe not now. I mean, we have 7 minutes left, literally, for the hour, but maybe at some stage we need to have a conversation around that, and especially since you're the acting HOD at the Department of Community and Safety in the Western Cape. I mean, there's so many instances and contexts that you are making reference to there that we should have that conversation around. I'm thinking around the issue of gang violence and gangsterism in the Western Cape in particular. I mean, that again goes back to the sense of community and the sense of community, or in the sense of what type of community do you actually want then? Do you want to live in? And under what circumstances do you want to live under? when we're talking about this specific issue there, Simeon. I mean, you know, we can't have the neighbor's child next door is literally selling tuk to my lady, and somehow I expect government, whether it be the Western Cape government, national government, or whoever else, must come down from the ivory towers and fix my situation. I'm not saying that there is no responsibility on government. Obviously there is, but at the same time, we need to be really reasonable, and we need to think this thing through,
yeah,
and take charge of our communities. And unfortunately, yeah, that element, in my opinion, is really, really sorely missing.
Yeah, Bishop, you're absolutely right. I think ultimately, it's said on many fronts. Don't expect somebody else to come from outside and fix what is inherent to where we are, inside here where we are. I think that's an important point that you're making. Ultimately, I think a lot of things around communities, if we as government or whatever sphere of government is concerned, I think we must start looking at what is good within communities and try and affirm those. Often we respond to problems in communities and then we want to develop a specific response to that problem. What that actually means is you're putting the money or the resources or those limited resources to a very specific response, which is often a knee-jerk response to what is there. However, if there are activities, if there are systems and processes within that community that is doing good, to what extent do we then rather resource those successfully for that to spread and that circle of influence to spread and ultimately make more spaces safe within those communities? And I think then the resources are basically going to affirm what is good as opposed to react what is bad.
I hear you 100%. Look, mate, I could have this conversation with you all evening long, but it's been, I really didn't think that you and I were going to have nearly an hour long conversation around 27 non-compliant liquor vendors being issued a fine. But I mean, there's a lot of societal issues that permeate from that. And that made it a fascinating conversation for me. So thank you so much for your time, and all the best. And I wish you well, and let's hope people behave themselves, keep it together over this festive season. And let it not be about the booze, but about family and loved ones and looking after ourselves.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gershaw, and thank you to your listeners.
Only a pleasure. Thank you. That was Simeon George, acting HOD at the Department of Community and Safety in the Western Cape. And for our Western Cape listeners, I hope they gave you some peace of mind that something is being done, albeit not easy at the same time. Let's also admit to that. 4 minutes to go before we get to 11 o'clock. Remember, after the 11 o'clock Eyewitness News, we open up lines, giving you an opportunity to chat to me about anything and everything that you want to. Some of you have been calling in about the power outage in your part, neck of the woods in the Western Cape. So do give me a call. Tell me what is the situation with that. Also, was the explanation given to us by the city? Remember, I'm not in Cape Town, so we're calling from Joburg, trying to hear from the city of Cape Town what's the issue. And from what we understood, they told us that they had a loss of supply at the Philippi substation. Is that a good enough explanation for you? Has some of your power been restored? If not, how so? And what are some of the innovative ideas that you're coming up with for being able to spend this holiday season with loved ones? Are you doing the old good old traditional thing and saying, stuff it, I'm going to get into my car, I'm going to drive or bus or whatever, I'm going to go all the way to Gran and Grandpa and family members, and I'm going to see them anyway? Or are you saying that, no, we're staying at home and we'll do Zoom or Skype or whatever the case may be for this particular holiday season? I'd love to hear what are some of your solutions. 2.5 minutes to go before we get to 11.